Good Morning Show with Oliver O.T. Thomas.
We're back. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show. Oliver O.T. Thomas, the early bird, and the entire WBOK listening audience. Man, once again, happy five-year anniversary to New Orleans East Hospital, man. Thank you, guys. Dr. Takesha Davis, her board. And, man, first of all, shout out to the original board, Mario Davis, who was the original director. Everyone who served out there deserves credit for what is right now an institution that's really critical and important to our community. And not just about hospital services, but about overall wellness. Wellness is a whole lot more than, you know, hey, I need to get operated on. I need a pill. I need some medicine. I have an attack. Wellness is about how we live in general. So I want to thank the team out there for opening up the hospital and partnering with the community to create a real wellness environment. So, Dr. Davis, happy 5 years. Let's not forget the Dumpster Funk, Trombone Shorty, award-winning, wonderful young man, Tank, the Soul Rebels, the mayor, Shamar Allen, Fifth Ward Weeby, Denisha. Turn up, turn out. Get out the vote. That's Friday, November 15th, 6 to 9 at Fulton Street Alley. Hey, man, look, nothing else, right? You may not like politics. You may not want to vote. But you're getting a whole lot of free food, free drink, and free concerts lately. So whatever's going on, you might as well give us your vote. We're giving you something, right? And if other folk have their money, then what is your what's your currency? Your currency is your vote. If you're talking about politics, now you may have some currency for other things, but if we're talking about politics, if they have their money, if they have their influence and they have their power, your currency is your vote. So you might as well use it, right? Well, back to where we are right now, my co-host, the great Lynn Wasserman. Lynn, welcome back to the Good Morning Show. How you doing?
I'm great.
You're not in New Orleans.
I'm ready to vote.
We put an aura state, so we put it, how you doing? That's like doing, right?
It's Madea style.
And
right?
Like, how you doing? You know, what street you live on? You know, how your mama and them, right? Now, I may not be concerned about them, but I just throw them in. I'm really asking you how your mama is. You know what I'm saying? That's how we do it, right, Lynn?
That's right. You know, right before we came in, we were talking to your producer, Lee, and he said, yeah, on Saturday, I got to go by my mama.
I got to go by my mama.
And I'm thinking,
I'm going to make groceries for her.
I'm wondering if in Chicago, Stacy, they say, I'm going by my mama.
Mm-mm.
That's a New Orleanian.
I'm not originally from Chicago. I'm originally from Cincinnati, Kentucky. So yeah, we have a little bit of that Southern flair.
Okay. Oh, good. Okay. Y'all got some of that woven in there.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to cross the river, the creek.
Yeah, the creek.
Not the
holler.
Not the H-O-L-L-E-R. That's like the Ninth Ward, New Orleans, the H-O-L-L-A. I'm going over the holler, y'all.
Yeah.
Flavor, right? Everywhere you go, man. That's right. The beauty of where we live, mm-hmm, and how we live. And I think the beauty of it is to respect those differences, mm-hmm, right? Because I think they make us who we are. Lynn, first of all, welcome back. Our African-American Jewish relationship series we're doing here. Our guest was out, first name out, last name standing last night. Good turnout, even though it was cold. It just really shows me people's quest for knowledge and information, right? Especially in this age when we all need allies in relationships, man, got to be proud of that.
And I heard it was wonderful. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. And we had a good student turnout.
Absolutely.
Is what I understand. It didn't make you feel old, did it?
I have young children that make me feel old. I don't need to go anywhere. You know, when my son jumps on my head and says, Daddy, you look goofy. And I think I'm sharp. You know, I got something going on. Pretty accomplished, you know what I'm saying? I don't need the outside world to do that. I'm humbled at home.
Right. Stacy. Well, maybe you can introduce Stacy as OT.
I will. Stacy Aviva Flint. Well, first of all, congratulations on a good turnout last night, a good discussion, and some really good questions, right? So this is, you know, this is a little different. It's a Good Morning Show, right? You know, we talk about real talk for real times. We keep it real. So, and sometimes we kind of raw, but respectful. So, talk about being black and Jewish.
Okay,
right.
So, what is that?
What
a
is
black
what,
Jew?
What like, is you?
Where
the, you,
uni- the unicorn.
Like, we say, where you be from?
Right. Exactly. Well, the interesting thing about being black and Jewish is that I don't know if it's a known fact, but about 20% of the American Jewish population are Jews of color.
Wait. How are we saying New Orleans, Lynn? For true?
For true.
Yes.
How could that be?
Well, the Jewish community has always been a multinational and a multicultural community from the very beginning. We're like a mosaic of people. Now, for a long time, we were kind of ostracized from the world because of that. It's like, why aren't Jews like everybody else to kind of stick to their own, look the same? Right. Why you got Jews who are in France and Africa and look all these different ways? And we were made to feel ashamed of that for a period of time. And that's why you kind of got this kind of a hegemony that you knew was like the kind of the white European Jews.
Absolutely.
And so the other Jews in India and China and Africa were kind of pushed to the side, even by their own people, because they were being told that to be European was to be you're on the right side of the track.
The same dominant conversation, the same dominant culture that had prevailed in every other walk of life was so different than Jewish. We never really thought about it like that. So the same thing that was prevailing in the world, it was actually happening amongst the Jewish community, even with all its diversity.
Exactly. So I actually converted to Judaism after about a 20-year struggle with God. Me and God had some deep conversations, some arguments. I'm like, why won't you leave me alone, and why won't these people leave me alone?
You didn't know your arms was too short to box with God?
I know. You know what? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But a 20-year struggle in terms of the theology, your faith, a spirituality?
It was all of that. For one thing, I couldn't get away from Jews. It's like
we're everywhere. You know?
I couldn't get away from them. I was raised by my grandmother and my great-grandmother. So we're talking about somebody who was born in 1881 and someone who was born in 1927.
Now, are they Christian, your grandmother and great-grandmother?
They were. They were nominal. They didn't really go anywhere. But they had very strong beliefs in the house. But one of the things that was very seminal for them was in the racial struggles of their times, which were much more prominent, although I feel like we're back in those times now, is that one thing that was consistent is their relationship with the Jewish community was something that gave them dignity and was something that they really treasured.
And y'all had those conversations?
We had those conversations, and my grandmother was very adamant about if she needed something, and it was critical to her health and safety, she wanted to go to her Jewish friends to get that help and service, if it was a doctor, if it was legal advice, if it was, you know, real estate, if it was comfort just in the racial struggles of the day. I remember a story my grandmother told me is that she was a companion to a Jewish family. She was not a maid. She was not a nanny.
Right.
She was a companion. And one day a contractor came to the house and said, you know what, we need to do some work on your house. And the owner wasn't going to be home. And he looked at my grandmother and he said, you know, well, you can tell your maid that to let me in. And the woman said, forgive me, I forgot her name. But the woman who employed my grandmother said, listen, that is not my maid. That is my children's companion. And you will address her as such. Her name is Emma. And from that day on, the way that my grandmother, when she told that story, and she was a very somber woman, but when she told that story, her head would be held high. And she had a kind of pride in her voice because she knew that to this family, who the children slept in her bed, they ate dinner with her, she disciplined the children. She knew that she was a part of their family and respected, and that even she was defended in front of someone else. And so those are the kind of stories that I heard growing up. So I already had a deep relationship and respect for what the Jewish community meant to my family.
Right. What was the thing that troubled you about, and Lynn, jump in any time, this 20-year battle with your spirituality, your fight with God, what was it that troubled you?
It wasn't so much of a trouble.
Because you seem to be, you have such a great spirit now, you know, that trouble doesn't permeate you. It doesn't emanate from you. So what could it have been then?
It wasn't so much of a troubling, but it was a curiosity. I would read the Psalms, and the Psalms would just speak to me. I felt like that they were saying the things that were in my heart and that were in my spirit. And so I had to investigate and I had to know more. And I'm a little bit of an academic, so mm-hmm. for me it's like, if this book wasn't originally written in English, what language was it written in? Mm-hmm. And then I found the language of Hebrew.
Right.
And there's nothing like being able to read in the original text. Mm-hmm. And when I started to read in the original text, I mean, the Bible was written, we know, in English, translated
right.
from
translated
Hebrew to
times.
Greek and to,
right.
And to right. English. But when you read in the original text, the theology doesn't come out the same. And so I was trying to figure out, well, why in English is it telling me one thing?
Right.
But in Hebrew, which I can read,
right.
it's telling me something
yeah.
different. And so I really was confronted with being able to read in the original language and having to deal with, what does it say, mm-hmm. and what do I know it says, and what does it say to me?
So it was as much as it was an academic connection and understanding, it also impacted your spirit.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and I just looked this up because I wanted to make sure I didn't get it wrong. Mm-hmm. As a person who's a lifelong Jew, sometimes I know, OT, that people who converted to Judaism know a lot more about it than people who were born into the religion. So I had to look it up to make sure. But the word Israel means to struggle with God.
Exactly.
And for centuries, Jews have struggled with what is the real meaning of this text and what is this really about. And they question God, and there's a struggle. It's a lifelong struggle. And it sounds to me, not being an expert on conversion, but Stacy came to this religion from a place of questioning and struggling. Mm-hmm. And that means a lot to me.
You know, in listening to you in your lecture last night, first of all, thank you again. You were able to walk us through the parallel between Zionism and Black nationalism and have some really, really good accounts for, right, why in many ways they're similar and how especially some of the great leaders in both those areas learn from each other. In many cases, use practices and tactics from the other. But I think also your life, your BA in political science and master's in urban planning kind of prepare you to actually do this work. Now, did you know that when you were studying or doing it? Because it all made sense in the lecture last night. Well, if I look at this woman's resume, right, given the time we're in with politics right now and planning, it was kind of predestined.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It does feel that way. I think that all of us are given missions in life, and if we listen to the spirits, we can move in that direction and be a help to the world.
Were you listening to the spirits then, or just making sure you can get a job?
I think it was definitely both.
No, our conversation in the studio right now with Stacey Aviva Flint. Stacey, Black nationalism and Zionism, very few have made the connection the way you have made it. That's a difficult piece, right? It's a lot of work. It's a lot of potential pushback, too. And it's difficult, especially given where we are today. Mm-hmm. Talk about why you're interested in that area.
I was very interested in it because usually we hear about African Americans and Jews with the civil rights and marching in Selma and
right.
Dr. King.
Right.
But I wanted to understand, did the Jewish and the African American community know about each other before then?
Mm-hmm.
And with all of our similarities in kind of like the worldwide persecution, did we know that? And I started to look into some of the history in some of the writings. I found that in the mid-1800s, African Americans and Jews were talking to one another across the continents, and in fact were bringing their issues to the world stage in tandem, saying, if you are going to deal with the Black question, you need to deal with the Jewish question. If you're going to deal with the Jewish question, then you need to deal with the Black question. And they were really upholding one another and challenging the world to take a look at two of the most persecuted people and see that in order for the world humanity to really truly be about brotherhood, we had to deal with these two communities.
Then, and of course, Lynn, jump in anytime you want, but this is piqued my curiosity to the point, right? Because just the way that, especially American history, in many cases European history, has relegated black history to a few pages or a few moments, they've left out so much of what you've uncovered in your research, right? Mm-hmm. Why?
You know what? That is a great question, and I found it actually difficult when I was doing my research.
Was it a conspiracy? Was it the lack of respect for both of those communities? Was it just kind of just the way it happened?
I think it can be many of those things. It can be a lack of respect. I think it could be a fear of our powerfulness together. I think that's what.
Yeah. I'm interested, and I'd like you to tell our audience, most of whom probably weren't there last mm-hmm. night, about the similarities between Zionism and black nationalism, and what has your research shown? Just give us, and I realize this is a short radio program, right. And you're going to have to encapsulate right. it in a very short period of time, but to the best of your ability, to give us a short summary of your thesis.
Sure. I really looked at it through the lens of historical trauma. And that when you challenge a group of people's origins, just like as I mentioned last night, you know, the old urban capping situation, when you started to talk about someone's hair and their clothes mm-hmm. and things of that nature, it could be funny. But don't you say anything about my mama.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're hitting at
Then it's not funny.
No, it's not funny. And words can turn to fists because you're hitting a primal wound because you're challenging where someone comes from and their origins, mm-hmm. their mama. And that's the kind of thing that happened with the African American and the Jewish communities because we were being challenged from our very origins, basically stating for thousands of years that Jews weren't even human, that blacks weren't even human. And so that's the commonality that I found between both.
And using religion to substantiate both.
Using religion to substantiate that very critically. Blacks were considered savages because mm-hmm. they weren't Christians, and Jews were considered, you know, Christ killers. And in fact, the reason why, you know, a lot of people say today, oh, Jews and money, Jews were actually forced into the money industry.
Yeah, I was when you were talking last night as someone who's been to Israel and the Middle East, Palestine, spent some time there, from the Golan Heights to behind the wall. I'll never forget Heydrich and Ulmers and the Nazi sympathizers more than sympathizers. And one of their comments was about Jewish ghettos mm-hmm. and how they had to cauterize those plague spots. And they talked about them the same way they talked about African-American ghettos mm-hmm. here in America.
Exactly.
It's like the exact same conversation.
Exactly. The same words. I mean, Jim Crow sign, it said no dogs, no Jews, and no Negroes.
Well, it was more than no Negroes. I did Smith's play at Anthony mm-hmm. Bean Theater that mm-hmm. highlighted that time. Absolutely.
Yeah. And in some of the pseudo racist theologies, mm-hmm. they always made sure that Jews understood where their place was in the hierarchy, mm-hmm. and they were right above the Negro or the black person.
Right.
And so in the mind's eye, if you are given the opportunity to kind of distance yourself from the most hated people, you might do that. And America kind of gave Jews kind of a white card when they came to America, and they were able to distance themselves from the stigma of being closely related to the black person. And that was a very hard psychological, I think what I talked about in my talk was that it was a psychological wound, racism and anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. that caused each community to try to find something that would restore their communal dignity. And I believe that that's what Zionism and black nationalism did.
And while we get into more of the parallels and what led you to this research, you know, I'm just thinking about, especially after listening last night, and the questions that people would have for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, these two groups, right? Whether it's the Ulmers and Frederick and Heydrich and calling all of our places plague spots that will be cauterized from Jewish ghettos to African-American ghettos, minimizing our existence as human beings. Then here you have Stacey Aviva Flint, right? And she would wear the mantle of both.
Mm-hmm.
Who would You know, most people are trying to assimilate
exactly.
into the more dominant culture. Most exactly. people are trying to get away from what many consider a curse or bearing or wearing those crowns of thorns. Mm-hmm. Why would you take on both?
Wow. I definitely believe that it was a calling. I am a spiritual person. And I believe that there are people who are called in this world to be bridge builders between people and to bring people back to their own, to the sense of our common humanity. And in the Jewish community, I saw myself. Mm-hmm. I saw my family. I saw my history. Mm-hmm. I've been privileged to raise my children in the Jewish community. But I never forget who I am, too, as a black woman and what has been given to me from my grandmother and my great-grandmother and our history here in America as slaves. I can trace my ancestors back to the 1700s mm-hmm. here in America. I have their manumission papers. And so to be able to know the deep history of both of those communities, I feel like that I can speak to both of those communities and say, we can look each other in the eye and see that deep pain that we both come from and then take that pain, transform it into healing, and try to bring not only us together, but other people together.
You know, I'm always struck by somebody like Stacy who is
Yeah, I'm
is
always
so
struck by anybody who puts themselves in front of the firing squad.
Absolutely. You know, and I may have said this on the program before, but, you know, for those of your listening audience who aren't looking at me and Stacy and you on Facebook, you know, I will just say I look like a middle-aged white lady. And when I walk around, you know, to the grocery store or walking on the street or something like that, an African-American person might look at me and go, well, it's just another middle-aged white lady. And the truth of the matter is I never feel that way. I always feel that I'm a Jewish person. I'm a Jewish woman. That's who I am. But as we say down here, I can pass for white.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Stacy,
you can't.
And the first thing I noticed about Stacy, after I looked into her beautiful eyes and saw what an attractive woman she was, the next thing I saw was the Star of David that she's got hanging around her neck and the Hamsa, both of which are Jewish symbols. So she's out there. So she'd be walking on the street, and a white person who's not looking at her Jewish symbols that she's wearing, might say, "Well, there's a nice, young looking, you know,
right.
black woman."
Right.
And
let me holler at her.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and not until they saw the Star of David and the Hamsa on you would they know that you're really out there. But you're choosing to, you know, to take on the mantle of both.
As a matter of fact, she had a similar encounter where there was a Caucasian, a white person who was comfortable talking to you on a train ride.
And it was actually a black brother. It was black brother.
Oh,
I want to hear the story.
Yeah. So I was on the train and a lovely older African-American gentleman was talking to me very gregariously. Mm-hmm. We were having an amazing
Y'all had a connection.
Time. We had a connection right. and a great time. And I was practicing my Hebrew, and I had taken mm-hmm. out my book. And he asked me, so is that Arabic you're reading? I go, no. He goes, is that a Quran you're reading? No. It's Hebrew. And I said this a couple times, and he cocks his head, and he looks at me. And the friendly look that he had on his face from the beginning totally disappeared. And for the rest of the ride, he no longer looked or spoke to me. I never had to say that I was Jewish. I'm sure he, you know, extrapolated that. But that loss of connection with him, it was palpable. And I actually tucked my star into my neck for the rest of the ride. And I was afraid of someone who looked just like me. But the response that I got was so visceral, it saddened me and made me afraid.
Well, you used the term Christ killer earlier, and I'm often reminded of the first time I heard that. As a college athlete, one of my teammates was an Italian kid from Pittsburgh, and there was another kid who was Jewish on the team. And when he walked away, he used the term, he said, that's one of them. Christ killers. It was the first time, and it made me wonder. Well, I wonder what he says about us. But that was the first time I'd heard that term in college from an otherwise real kind of gregarious, real personable kid, mm-hmm. who we called this kid Jimbo, who he identified Jimbo as being Jewish. He didn't identify him as being Jewish. His term for him was Christ killer.
And I like what you say. You wonder what he said about black people behind.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So to what did you, and obviously you didn't have a connection with this African-American gentleman after he realized that you were Jewish, but to what did you ascribe the look that he gave you or the lack of connection after that? I mean, do you what was your supposition about it?
I think my supposition definitely was that when he heard that it was Hebrew, that he made the connection that I was Jewish, and whatever negative ideas that he had about Jews was then assigned to me, no matter that I was black just like him.
But before we go into break, one of the questions that I've gotten of people who have texted me is that, how have you experienced discrimination within the Jewish community, and especially as being a Jew of color, and how have you dealt with that?
You know what? I want to be totally honest. I don't think that my experience is typical mm-hmm. of a lot of African-American Jews. Mm-hmm. I came into the community through an academic network mm-hmm. and through a through work mm-hmm. and a strong social network. Mm-hmm. And so I had about 20 years in the Jewish community of people knowing me all over the country. My social capital was quite strong coming into right. the community. Right. I don't think that...
You were Stacey Aviva Flint already.
So, right. And I had some great mentors who put me out there, put me in speaking engagements mm-hmm. and political situations to speak for
the
community.
You had a level of prominence already.
So, yeah. So I don't want to not acknowledge that I had a level of privilege that, mm-hmm. that perhaps some other Jews of color have not had.
That's honest.
Yeah.
Well, Stacey Aviva Flint, guys, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I wanted to highlight, right, from Herschel to Marcus Garvey, and some of those other very prominent accounts, man, about the nexus, the relationship, Zionism and black nationalism. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back after the break. You don't want to miss it.
WBOK, New Orleans.
You're listening to The Good Morning Show with Oliver O.T. Thomas.
We're back. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show. 8:39 a.m. on this cold Stacey. We love us some Stacey Aviva Flint, yeah. But let me tell you something. Next time you come down here, don't you bring nothing else from Chicago. If it ain't a Gibson steak, a Johnny Rocket shake, a malt, you know, or some Michael Jordan paraphernalia signed by him, don't you bring the Hulk. And the cold and nothing off of Lake Michigan with you again. We good?
Okay. I try to remember that.
I know you can amen that, right? Absolutely. In the studio with the Stacey Aviva Flint, Jew of color, urban planner, Jewish communal professional. We're talking about the origins and parallels between Zionism and black nationalism. First of all, last night you gave, not only did you give us a good talk, you named names, right? You gave us historical accounts, right? You talked about a lot of facts. Share some of those, not just those parallels and where we come together, but some of those people who were instrumental in Zionism and black nationalism.
Okay, great. Well, some of the people that really impacted me were Martin Delaney. Martin Delaney was the father of black nationalism, and he worked with Frederick Douglass. He was very prominent in early black newspapers, and he really wanted African Americans to have a sense of their own identity and a sense that they were humans and they were just like anyone else. And after he was disheartened by the prospect of a Black American citizenship at the time, he really focused on immigration back to Africa, mm-hmm. And really building, a Black identity. And I compared him with Leon Pinsker, who wrote The Auto Emancipation, because they were about the same time in the mid-1800s. And it was interesting that when each of them spoke about their own community's need for self-respect and even to immigrate to a homeland, they referenced the other.
Right.
So Leon Pinsker basically said in Auto Emancipation that just like every other community in the world that's been oppressed, and he named the Negroes, that's what we called at the time.
Right.
He named that in his writings in the 1800s. And here I saw that Martin Delaney was saying the same thing in his writings. He was talking about oppressed people, and he named the Jewish community in his writings. And these people were writing about 30 years apart, mm-hmm. and I just thought it was fascinating that at that point they had made the connections themselves without the internet, with limited press, that they knew what the other was going through, and they found that it was important to make their argument saying, hey, we also have an example of this other community that's going through something similar, and we've got to, our issues are similar.
Right. And so bring us up to the present day. That's a long time ago, and it's, it's many decades hence.
Mm-hmm.
Why, in your opinion, the schism between Blacks and Jews?
Okay. Yeah. Where did we kind of go our separate ways? Especially because you look at the economic relationships, retail relationships that had, in many cases, our communities were intertwined. African Americans couldn't shop or do business or commerce many places, but they could with Jewish businessmen mm-hmm. and women in retailers. If you look at the civil rights movement, the many Jewish intellectuals, academics, and lawyers who befriended folk like Malcolm and Martin and many others, where did we lose that?
Okay. So I think it's a multi-layered story. I don't want to forget Marcus Garvey and the importance.
Herzl and Garvey were important too.
Right.
In your talk last night.
Right. But Marcus Garvey did something very amazing mm-hmm. to the Black psyche. And what he did was he was kind of the first to coin Black is beautiful mm-hmm. and an allegiance to other Black people, regardless of what the issues were.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you start to move out of the civil rights movement with, unfortunately, the assassination of Dr. King, Black nationalism really moved into that mantle of Garveyism of that Black was the most important thing to be loyal to. And so Jews were looked at as white people, not only on the outside, but also too, their trajectory was different mm-hmm. economically. And so you had this moving away from the Jewish family started to move out of predominantly African-American areas where they were living
Absolutely.
Together because they were able to take advantage of some of these programs in America mm-hmm. for homeowners that were for white people.
Right.
So as you start to have the physical distance, mm-hmm. When you're not seeing your neighbor, it's harder to discriminate or feel distant from somebody that you're living right next to.
Right.
So if a Jewish family and a Black family are living right next to one another, there is some kind of understanding and there's some kind of relationship.
Right.
But when my neighbor now lives 30 miles away and
in a white community.
Yeah, right. They have left the community. That feels like an abandonment. And also, too, as I talk about Black Power and Jewish Politics, a book by Mark Dollinger, I think he does a great job of talking about there was a need in the Black Power movement to feel like that the movement was being led by Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they purposely and specifically pushed the Jewish community out of the NAACP and out of SNCC and out of different organizations. And really, the Jewish community understood that that was a necessity.
Cheney, Goodman, and Swarner.
Yeah, yeah. They understood that it was time for the black community to self-determine their own strategies. It was hurtful, yes, but it was important. And it actually did something important for the Jewish community. The Jewish community was then took a page out of black nationalism and black power and said, if black is beautiful, then Jewish is beautiful. And that's where you get the plethora of Jewish studies programs that came along with the African-American studies program. You got the strengthening of different Jewish communities because they were really looking at the black community and using – it was flipped around. They were using black power tactics to increase Jewish consciousness.
This is so fascinating to me. And – there's an element of racism in any tribalism. So when you say black is beautiful or Jewish is beautiful, it doesn't become a racist statement. So I'll give you one of the classic examples in the Jewish community. I'll be talking to another, a Jewish person, and I'll say, I want my children to marry a Jew. And they'll say, why? And I'll go, because I want the continuity of the Jewish people. And they will say, but isn't that racist? Mm-hmm. Because what you're basically saying is you want your child to marry somebody else who's just like you. Mm-hmm. And although it might be a Jew of color, in at least 80% of the cases, it's not a Jew of color. So I guess my question is how do you talk about the difference between tribalism and racism, and how does it play out? I mean, how do you espouse black as beautiful or Jewish as beautiful without being a racist?
That is an amazing question. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that question. I think that it has to do with historical trauma. And when you have a group of people who have been victimized over many generations and many years, there can be a time when there becomes self-hatred and internalized oppression. And I think that the love of self and one's own community is the first and important step. Mm-hmm. You don't need to stay there, but if you don't get to the point where you can actually look at yourself and accept yourself and your people and your origins and say, I am beautiful, where I come from is beautiful, you cannot turn around and look at another human being and see that in them. Because when I can see myself as black as beautiful, that I am a human, I am not a monkey, I am not a slave, mm-hmm. I am not inferior, that raises me to the level to raise my head up and look at you and say, wherever you come from, you should feel the exact same way about yourself. And then we get to the point of, okay, now we are all men, humans, and let's work together. But if I don't love myself first, I'm not going to be able to love any other human being.
Well, we're talking to Stacey Aviva Smith, Jew of color, urban planner, Jewish communal professional, a BA in political science from the University of Cincinnati, Masters of Urban Planning, Public Policy from the University of Chicago, Illinois, and a candidate, also a master's candidate in Jewish studies right now. So we got a few minutes left, man. It's amazing how time flies, right? Mm-hmm. Where do we go from here?
You know what? That is an amazing question. I love something that James Baldwin said in one of his speeches. He says, since it is through your sense of your own history that you arrive at your identity, and no one has ever arrived at a sense of his own identity without it, that is why ancestors are important. The measure of one's dignity depends on one's estimate of oneself. Mm-hmm. We've got to understand who we are and where we come from. We've got to delve into those not so nice stories and understand that our communities were deeply traumatized and hurt. The African American community and the Jewish community. We've got to give honor to our ancestors. And then when we have that dignity and estimation of ourself, then we can sit down at tables and we can talk to each other. How did that make your family feel? How have you dealt with those issues? Because we like to have those conversations insular and together, but we should be having those conversations between communities. Because when you can see that someone else and their family have had those same struggles, then that's when you come together. That's why Black nationalism and Zionism were talking to each other, because they saw their struggles, and then they worked together. This is a critical time in our country where we should be coming together and seeing that we have some of the same challenges, because when they are shouting in Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us, those are the very same people who were looking at African Americans as lynching opportunities.
Stacey, I want to use my last comment to make this even more personal for you. It was based on a comment. There were quite a few people there last night, curiosity seekers,
mm-hmm.
Many who wanted to see where you were coming from,
mm-hmm.
some who wanted to push back in terms of theory and application.
Mm-hmm.
And one academic there who I respect does a lot of work. After listening to you last night, he said, you know, I get it. He said, just like this, he said, the sister can be a conduit to a better place for all of us because she doesn't deny her blackness.
Exactly. You've got to be authentic and be who you are. I will never, ever stop being a proud black woman, but I will always, always be a strong, proud Jewish woman. And with those two things coming together, I hope to build bridges between not only our communities, but other communities.
You know, I want to tell a real quick story because I know we're running out of time, but I think this will resonate with our audience and with you, Stacy, and you, OT. My father was a traveling salesman in the South. He sold shoes on the road. He would lug big suitcases into small shoe stores and sell shoes for his company. And during the summertime, sometimes I would go with him, and we would go into some rural areas of the South where he was trying to sell shoes. And we walked into one day, and he mentioned to the merchant standing there that he was Jewish. And a few minutes, I walked off and was looking at something else. And a few minutes later, he says, okay, it's time for us to go. Let's go. So we walked out. And I was a teenager at the time, so I was embarrassed by anything that my father did. And I said, Dad, why did you mention to that man that we were Jewish? And he said, honey, I want everyone to know I'm Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish. And frankly, if he didn't want to sell buy shoes from a Jewish person, I'm not sure I wanted to sell them to him. And this is, don't ever be ashamed mm-hmm. of who you are. And he said, you know, unlike people who are black, people might look at us and not realize that we're Jewish. So mm-hmm. it's our responsibility to tell them who we are. And I will never forget that day. That was a turning point in my life. And you, Stacy, have taken on the mantle. You didn't have to, but you were called, and I can't tell you how deeply we appreciate it.
Stacy Aviva Flint, academic, intellectual, in all of the professionals, with all the letters that accompany you. I think what we found out last night and what we see is that you lead with your humanity. Any last words you want to share with our listening audience? How can people follow you in terms of your writing, your speaking engagements? How can they reach out to you in the future? How can they stay connected?
Great. Well, I'm on Facebook as Stacy Aviva Flint. You can mm-hmm. look me up. On Twitter, I'm Mocha Jewess.
I love it. It sounds delicious.
Right.
It does. It does. Right. Reach out. Ask questions. I'd love to hear the information and the research mm-hmm. that other people are doing. And I think that one of the things that I really like is that during times of crisis, wise people build bridges, not dams. And so I hope that many of us become more bridge builders.
During times of crisis, wise people build bridges. Not dams, absolutely. I think it was the Taoist General Lao Tzu who, when they asked him why he took care of the people he defeated, he said, I build them golden bridges so their children's children won't hate us, so that we, maybe one day we can work together. Stacey Aviva Smith in line with Lowe's. I know Stacey Smith. That's why I keep almost wanting to say that. Stacey Aviva Flint in line with Lowe's, right, with Powerful Company. Guys, you promise to come back in the future when you're here?
Yes, thank you.
OT and the Early Bird, Lynn.
Thank you.
Host, anything you want to say?
No, it's been great. Thank you.
Hey, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, all things OT and the Early Bird, guys. We'll be back after the break.